Back on Downtown as we continue to celebrate the upcoming 50th anniversary of the premiere of one of the landmark television shows of all time, MASH, which made its debut in September of 1972. And today, we're happy to welcome back to the show gentleman who played Captain B.J. Honeycutt for the final 8 seasons of the series. Great for us to catch up once again with our friend Mike Farrell.
How are you doing, Rich?
I'm doing fine, Mike. How are you?
All right, thanks.
Excellent, excellent. Well, we got the 50th anniversary coming up, so wanted to talk with you about MASH, which we've covered before, but maybe get in to some other areas. And let's start with the recent passing of Burt Metcalf. What did he mean to the show?
Oh, Burt was, you know, you have beams in a ceiling, you have mainstays in the world. Burt was solid. I'll tell you a story. Burt was the casting director before. He was an actor, and then he was the casting director. He knew all sides of the business, but he was the casting director at Universal when I was under contract there in the early 70s. And we knew each other slightly. And I remember one day running into him on the lot, and he said, "Oh, I just wanted to say goodbye." And I said, "Goodbye? Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going over to 20th. I'm going to do a show over there." I said, "Oh, good for you. That's great." And off he went. We had no contact subsequently until, well, I guess it would have been 2 or 3 years later when I was asked to come over and meet about the possibility of joining the cast of MASH. I think of that a lot. I was with Burt when he got sick and spent some time with him at the hospital in his last days. And I remember saying, typically Burt, typically generous of this guy who was, at that time, was afraid he was, I shouldn't say afraid, felt that he was dying. And I said, you know, I want to say again, thank you for opening me to providing for me the one of the great experiences of my life, and certainly the highest experience of my career. And I said, it's I owe it to you. And he said, and he wasn't able to talk much, but he looked me in the eye, shook his head negatively, and pointed at me and said, "No, it was you."
Oh, wow.
I will never forget that. And I'll never forget him. I mean, we were friends on the set, but we were friends afterward. All of us remained close. And Burt was the kind of the mainstay. He was the beam holding up the rafters, I guess.
Mike, who were some of the unsung heroes of the series that that maybe the viewer didn't see or just were names in the credits but were instrumental to the show's success?
Well, Larry Gelbart, of course, was known to the industry and hopefully to the world at large because he was the comic genius who, to call him comic genius is to give him credit for his comedic skills, but he was far more than that. He was a genius, and he was the man who, along with Gene Reynolds and Burt, was a contributor there as well. But they were the ones that formed the idea. And Aldo, when they came to him with the show, I've subsequently been told that they had a conversation, and Alan said, "This is not. I won't do it if it's, you know, hijinks at war. We need to, this has to be a show about people and the people that did what they heroically did." in the face of such horror and tried somehow to maintain their sanity. So then you had some writers I didn't know very well because I know of them, but the first 3 years of the show, Tim Fitzell and Eric Greenberg, I think, were two writers who were, they really went to a lot for the scripts. Larry wrote a tremendous number of the scripts, but and always polished them, I think. And then when I came aboard, we had Thad Mumford and Dan Wilcox. We had David Isaacs and Ken, whose last name, forgive me, I'm blanking on.
Ken Levine.
Levine, thank you. Subsequently, Alan Katz and Don Rio. And I mean, these wonderful, wonderfully talented people who got it. And, the comic geniuses of the show, John Rappaport. I mean, there were so many people. Karen, I'm going to blank on her last name right now. Karen was first or second female writer we had. And I've come to this place in my life where names are my are the bane of my memory.
Karen Hall.
Karen Hall, thank you very much. Gosh, you know more. See, you know more about the show than I do. Anyway, it was there on the page. You know, we could add to it to give it the riffs that our abilities allowed us to provide, but it was there on the page, and they did their homework, these folks. They actually, Bert and Gene and Larry did a trip to Korea to look at the 8055 MASH, which was the one that Dr. Hornberger actually served in. And they made up 1277, but he made it up, I guess, originally. We had Doug Stubbs was the property master on the set. The people who wardrobed us, particularly the people who wardrobed Jamie. everybody made a contribution, and they all understood what we were doing, and they all felt a part of what we were doing. We had a woman, Connie Isay, was a surgical nurse who was a regular with us. She was there every day and stood in as an extra or a background player. But Connie made sure that we did the surgical techniques properly. We handled things, the procedures, appropriately. And we had Walt Dischel, the doctor, was our medical technical advisor, but Connie was the same. And Walt would look at the scripts and make sure the scripts were right. And periodically, I guess he'd talk if we asked him about a particular procedure, one or another. But Connie was there every day, and it was she was just an extraordinarily thoughtful, decent woman. So, so many of these people, Scotty, the guy that took our phone messages and joined in some of the hijinks. I remember one time Alan came to me with a letter from a guy. It was a con, It was a guy that said he had this idea about building this wall in San Francisco out of bricks, and bricks would be painted with the names of every person who contributed $10,000 to this fund that he was building to deal with the homeless and the destitute and blah, 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 bullshit, excuse me for using that term. And Alan was really frosted. I mean, we all got kooky mail as well as most of the wonderful mail we got. But this particular one really ticked him off. And he came over and showed it to me. He said, "Can you believe this jerk, pulling this?" And I thought to myself, God, man, this guy really got under his skin for whatever reason. So I went over to Scotty, or the guy who answered the phone and took messages. And I said, tomorrow, tell Alan that let's call this guy Tom Jones. Tell Alan that the man by the name of Tom Jones called for him and wants him to call back. And Scotty said, what do you mean? I just said, just tell him that. And he said, okay, sure. The next day, Alan got a call from Tom Jones. And he said, what? To Scotty. I said, all I can tell you is he called. And so Scotty very quickly got into the gag. So the that day, I said, thank you for doing that. Now, the next day, tell him he called twice. But we got to the third day. I had Western Union send a telegram in his name to Alan, and Alan was getting more and more cooked by the audacity of this guy. And then to cap it off, at the end of the week, maybe it was, I hired a friend who was an actor who Alan didn't know to play this guy. And I called the publicist on the show at the lot, and I said, this man's going to come on the set, on the lot, and I want you to bring him down and introduce him to Alan. He has a charity that he needs, that Alan wants to hear about. And my friend came in, and Chuck Panama, the publicist, said, okay, sure, no problem. And my friend came on the lot, and Chuck brought him on the set. Alan, I want you to meet Tom Jones. He's this gentleman. He's in. Alan, what you should see, I mean, his face was just ashen looking at me. And he and Chuck then departed. And my friend just gave Alan this pitch about the wonderful thing that would happen if he could just give the money and have his name on the brick in the wall. Alan did not strike him, but he ushered him off the set. And came over to me and said, can you believe that? And then I had one of those people you have come in and sing a song that has some balloons and sings a song that we can concocted about you've been had, my friend. And, and he, oh God, Alan's mouth was wide open for hours after that. It was hysterical.
So that leads me to believe then that the episode "The Joker Is Wild" was certainly based on the real life practical jokes that were such an important part of that set.
Absolutely, absolutely. Bert Metcalf came up to me and he said, "Jesus," he said, "these things you pull in the guys." He said, "I used to pour salt in the sugar shaker for the coffee when they were having coffee in the mess. Just stuff, you know, just to kind of have fun." And Bert said, "We've got a story here." So they wrote a story about the people doing jokes on everybody. And the Joker turned out to be BJ.
We're talking with Mike Farrell here on Downtown. Now we've talked about it with you before. You've been offered some other sitcom opportunities, but you weren't really interested in just doing another sitcom. You wanted to do something of quality.
Well, I'd been offered a number of shows after that, and it was all some version of either BJ Goes Home or, you know, something kind of hope they wanted to be similar to MASH. But, you know, I didn't. I frankly felt we had done the best television series, the best kind of work that was possible to be done. And I didn't know that I'd ever find something. And I made some movies. I produced some movies. Settled a partnership with my then partner Marvin Minoff, and we did a number of movies for television and a couple features, and had a good time. And stayed, you know, active. I directed a film, and we stayed in the business. But I just couldn't imagine that there'd be an acting experience on a regular basis for me that would ever measure up.
And you knew this was going to be something special when you joined the show. And was it the meeting you had with Alan when you two went out to to lunch, and he sort of explained his view of the show?
Well, it was more than that, but I had never met Alan before. I was invited to meet Larry and Gene and Bert, and we just talked. Wayne had determined he was going to leave, or was threatening to leave, and they weren't sure if their studio was going to be able to meet his contract requirements. So they decided they would reach out to some people and see if they could come up with somebody to replace him, if that was the case, if that became necessary. So when it became very pretty clear that they were going to have to replace him, they asked me and I don't know how many others to come in and meet. And at that time, I was under contract at Universal. I had done a television series with Tony Quinn, and that was one of the wonderful experiences I'd had. And prior to that, I'd done one with Brod Crawford, who was another, it was another powerful experience in many ways. And and Universal kept looking for something for me, and they wanted me to do this and wanted me to do that, and we kept disagreeing. This meeting came along for MASH, and I said up to my agent, I said, "Can I do this? I'm under contract." And he said, "Having a meeting is not going to hurt." So I didn't frankly know the show. I had heard of it. I didn't know Bert was associated with it. I may have told you this story. I was going to go out to dinner with a friend, and I went to pick him up, and he said, "Well, I can't go yet. I've got to watch MASH." And I said, "Come on, man." He said, no, I got to finish watching MASH." And so I went in, and we sat, and I remember seeing a scene with Gary Radar, Gary Berghoff, in which he was doing that character, and he was, being zeroed in from all sides by people. Everybody wanted him, and the bombs were going off, and the gunfire was happening, and the wounded were coming in, and the choppers, and the this and the that. And he was this kid, this naive kid, and he was trying to keep it all together. And I remember being knocked out. I thought, by God, that is really amazing, that show, and this cast, the way they're doing this. So it sort of emblazoned itself on my memory, and but it was a show that was already going on, and they had their cast, so there was nothing that could be done about it, from my point of view. And then when I was still in the contract at Universal, producer called me, and he said, "I've got a television series I'd like you to do." And I said, "Well, can I see the script?" And he said, "Sure," and he sent it to me. And it was, as you suggest, it was a kind of a joke show. It was, so many jokes per page sitcom that had no heart at all. And I said, "Gee, it's very nice of you to think of me, but thank you, but no thank you." And he said, "What do you mean?" And I said, "I mean, no thank you." And he said, you're turning down the lead in a television series?" And I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Why?" And I said, I didn't want to tell him I thought his show was stupid. So I said, "Well, it's not MASH." And he kind of looked at me like he didn't know what I was talking about. And, but I'll never forget that, because it was some months later that the call came to go over and have this meeting. And I thought, God, could it be possible? I met the guys, and I'd been around. I'd been under contract. I'd done these series, that stuff, but I was as nervous as a cat. I thought, I didn't want to trip over my feet or slobber, but I thought this was, manna from heaven. And they were just as sweet. And the one thing I said was, "I'll tell you what, I understand whether or not this is going to work out is a big question, but I wouldn't be interested in coming in and playing Trapper John and stepping into Wayne's boots and just saying, new actor playing Trapper John." And they said, "Oh, no, absolutely not. We understand that would be an insult to the audience." But this is the military. People die. People, you know, are transferred out. So we can have somebody transfer in. I said, well, as long as we understand each other, that's the only circumstance that I would find unacceptable. But other than that, you know, I would crawl across the city to do this show. Then I got a call back, and they said, would you come in and do a test with Alan, a screen test? And they said, this is not about whether you can act. We know that. It's about how the two of you interact, what kind of chemistry, if any, happens between the two of you. And I did that, and it was 3 days later, I guess, I got a call and said, you got it. And I got a call the same day from Alan, as you suggested, saying, would you have dinner with me? And I said, you bet. You bet. And we sat and talked and talked and talked about his view of the show, about what he hoped for the show, about just, you know, getting us in sync. And it was like magical time, just talking to this guy about what he viewed as the possibilities that this show presented in terms of reaching an audience about something that was significant in life and meaningful. And it calmed my fears because I felt very worried that, because I knew they had all gotten along, but, you know, they were storied as being friends. And I thought, there's the possibility that this jerk coming in to taking the place of one of their brethren is going to be not welcome. So Alan's taking the time to have dinner with me calmed much of that. But it was the next morning when I went to work, walked on the set on stage 9, and first person that came up to me was Gary Berghoff, stuck out his hand, said, welcome. Happy to have you with us. Then came Loretta and Jamie and Bill and Larry. And it was just fabulous, just fabulous.
Well, Loretta was on with us a couple of days ago, and she said that's one of the things that helped make the show such an enduring success, is there wasn't an attempt to replace those beloved characters who had left the show, but it was an opportunity for the writers and the cast to explore new characters in different types of relationships.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. I mean, for me, it was just good godsend luck. But I remember when Larry Linville decided to leave, and he had done a wonderful job, but it was an impossible character ultimately to play. And Alan and I had become uncomfortable by that time with the idea of making fun of somebody who may be crazy. So we were all, Larry and Alan and I and the rest of everybody, trying to figure out how to work this. And Larry finally said, you know what, I think I need to move on. I've done everything I can do with this character. And then Bird came over to us one day and he said, I've got a guy, after Larry had left, I've got a guy that's going to pin your ears back. he's going to be every bit as good a surgeon as you two, and he's going to be your intellectual match and a challenge, because he's going to be just the exact opposite of the two of you. And it was David Ogden Stiers, and it was, I got to say, it was love at first sight. David was just brilliant, and it was an example of what you just said. Loretta had talked about that. They had the intelligence. Gene and, by that time, Larry was gone, but Gene and Bert said, "Oh yeah, no, we've got to do this the right way." And man, did they ever!
There are so many great episodes through the years, but I wanted to bring up a couple. One of my all-time favorites, and I tear up just thinking about it, is the episode entitled Death Takes a Holiday, where BJ is trying to make sure a patient doesn't die on Christmas Day. What a powerful episode.
It was extraordinary. And, you know, they gave me that challenge. I directed it. And And I guess I wrote part of the script, and I think it's one of the finest shows we did in terms of making the point that these people are connected. These people overseas, risking their lives, are connected to all of us, and it's not just their families; it's all of us. And when this idea came up that this guy might die on Christmas Day, and BJ and the rest of the people couldn't stand the idea that his family would always have that hovering over their Christmas holiday, that's the day their loved one, father, husband, son, died in the war. We thought, God, this really has to be done to perfection. And the gang really pulled it off, I think.
Also love the work you do, especially in a period of adjustment, because we really got to see the anger and the frustration that BJ was dealing with.
Oh, man. That was a funny one. There were two for me. There was that one, and there was when Radar Goes Home, and Peg lets me know that when they went down to meet him to get off the ship, Aaron, my baby daughter, ran up to him, called him Daddy.
Yeah.
So that one was a heartbreaker. And then Period of Adjustment, about the falling in love, or like, or whatever. Yeah. I mean, they're just, it's the challenges that they presented us were just fabulous. You couldn't wait to open the new script and see what they've wrought for us.
And at a time when so much television was pretty rote, pretty by the book, willing to take chances and do things differently. And I think one of the best examples of that is The Interview.
I agree. People ask me what's my favorite episode, and I always say The Interview. I mean, you know, how can you pick a favorite? But I trust you know the story. The writers wrote their brains out, and we would do 24 episodes, and they would write 24 scripts. And as Bert said recently, you know, this one will never make it. This is going to end up being awful. And then halfway through, he'd say, well, maybe it's got a chance. And then we got to the end of it, and he said, we pulled it off again. But in this case, they had written their brains out and had come up with all 24, and then CBS called, and they said they want a 25th episode.
Right.
And they said, oh, my God, how do we do this? And they looked and looked and looked and thought about it, and then they thought of the Edward R. Murrow, You Are There.
Mm.
And Gene, I remember Gene coming up to each one of us with a little pad of paper and a recorder, saying, "I want you to extemporize. I want you to ad lib your answer in character to the questions on this list." And we're going to have a reporter. It turned out to be Cleve Roberts, who was quite famous here in L.A., come in and do a kind of Edward R. Murrow-esque visit to the MASH during the war and interview each of us. And he did, and we wrote the scripts, our own scripts, to answer the questions he posed. And then, of course, they threw into his script a couple of questions that weren't written.
Mm.
That we didn't know were coming, and we had to, again, at the moment, as the cameras are running, hear this new question and respond to it in character, and I thought afterward, what wonderful people these are! Just what you know that they had such faith in us,
right,
and such willingness to push the edges all the time, and it was just thrilling.
Where did you watch the finale?
we got together at the Fox. Fox set up this big screening theater they have. The day before, I guess, it aired. And we all came and brought our respective spice, husband, friends, wives, whatever, and the whole crew. It wasn't just the actors. It was the whole bunch. And we watched it and wept and laughed and wept again. And because that was a tough one. I remember Bert saying, as we were shooting a scene, Bert directed the last one, and he said, "Okay, wait. He said, "God," he said, "I've never been in a situation where I've had to ask actors to stop crying."
Am I right that the wonderful message that BJ leaves for Hawkeye, that was your idea?
No, I wish it was my idea. The message that BJ left was Bert's idea. The setup was, you know, BJ can't say goodbye. He wasn't willing to say goodbye. We'll see you. I'll see you. I swear I'll see you. But Bert had, he said, I remembered that I was in a camp when I was a kid, and we had these stones, and people would write notes to other people on them and take pictures of them. And he said, I thought this was the great way for BJ to say goodbye, and it was perfect. I don't know how you come up with something better. As the camera pulled out, they took the shot of it, and it was our way to say goodbye and thank you to the audience and, you know, to the world for giving us the opportunity to do this show and to receive it and embrace it the way they had for so many years.
You told our friend Mark Freeman a wonderful story a few years back about going back to shoot a different show and poking your head into Studio 9 and the memories that brought back.
Oh, it was stunning. I actually wrote about it and just sent it to the gang, as I think of them. I was doing a film and we were on stage 10. And I said, I need to take some time. I'm going to walk over to stage 9. And I walked in, and it was like I was going to work again. Mm. I could hear the voices. I could see the people. It was ghosts, people who have passed on. It almost smelled, you know, like it did. I was so moved by the experience of just walking on the set that I had to sit down and write it out for everybody who would understand what I was talking about, and they all did. And I guess I told that to Mark as well.
You know, obviously, anytime you work together in an ensemble, people form a bond, but this one seems a particularly strong one to have lasted for all these years. And, you know, no matter who we talk to from the cast, it's a bit overused, but in this case, you certainly all seem like a family.
It's a kind of cliche in the business to say, oh, yes, if we formed a family when we were there, but we did. We loved each other and still do. We've been to too many services and talked about people who are with us no longer. We've honored their memories, but we do it as a unit, and it's because we still feel a part of that unit, and it's something that'll never leave me. I know, it's clear to me that it's the same with everybody else.
From your perspective, Mike, why are we still talking about it 50 years later? Why are people still watching, and why do new generations of fans find this show and embrace it?
I think Gene Reynolds came up with what I consider to be the best answer to that question, and that is that it was the perfect existential situation. He said, everybody doesn't go to war. Every man doesn't put on a uniform. Everybody doesn't suffer the same set of circumstances, but everybody understands having to be separated from the ones they love and having to do so for a reason that is a good reason, but a painful one. And he probably put it better than I did, but just now, but I think he was exactly right. People, you just said it, I get letters every day from people who talked about what MASH meant to them and how important it was to their lives. And it's a little bit of a, I'm struggling to find the word. It's not a burden, but it's a big responsibility to be part of something that has had that kind of chemical, emotional reaction in the lives of so many people. I think I did tell you this story. I was, when I was doing the show, I was asked to come to Wisconsin, I think it was, to do a telethon to raise some money for a charity. And I did. And then there was we were doing the thing during the day, and then there was a break. And the guy said, you can go sit down or have a cup of, have a drink of water or whatever you want. And I said, I think I'll just go out and take a walk around a little bit. I've got 15 or 20 minutes. And he said, sure. So I went down the street, just walked in, I think it was Green Bay, Wisconsin. And I'm just looking, you know, around, and beautiful day, and a guy's coming toward me. And as he gets close, I see that he recognizes me, and he stopped. And he said, hey. And I said, yeah. And he stuck his hand out. He says, how the hell are you? And I said, I grabbed his hand and shook it. I said, I'm fine. How the hell are you? And then he suddenly, I saw his eyes open wide, and he leaped back. And he said, oh, my God, I just realized I don't know you.
Wow.
And I said, that's quite all right. You've just charmed the hell out of me, and thank you. And he said, how does it feel? And I said, what do you mean? He said, how does it feel to have half a relationship formed with millions and millions of people? And that's a question, how do you answer that question?
That's wonderful. Mike, thank you so much, as always. I really appreciate every time you make some time for us.
Oh, I'm always happy to talk to you, Rich. And I appreciate your paying attention to this wonderful group of people.
Absolutely. Give our best to Shelley as well.
Thank you, I will.
All right. Thank you, Mike. Be well.
You take care.